Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast. The money was already approved. Taxpayers already paid it. The budget already counted it. On paper, the help existed. But where did it go? That is the question this whole story keeps dragging us back to. Because tonight, we are going to follow that dollar from government offices through private corporations, past apartment buildings, medical clinics, nonprofit contracts, consulting firms, and the quiet middlemen most Americans never see. And by the time we are done, poverty may stop looking like a simple story about who got help, and it might start looking like something colder. A machine built around the money before it ever reaches them. Because the strangest thing about this dollar is not that it disappears. It is how many people can touch it, build it, manage it, process it, and get paid from it before it ever reaches the person it was supposed to help. So picture this. A little girl sits in a plastic chair with a box of broken crayons, the kind every waiting room seems to have. She is drawing a house with a tree and a yellow sun in the corner, the kind of picture kids draw when they still think houses are simple things. Every few seconds, she looks up at her mom, and her mom is not looking back. She wants to, but she can't. She is staring at a stack of paper she has already read 20 times, as if the words might change if she keeps looking. There's rent, medical bills, a shutoff notice, an application that has been processing for almost 3 months. That word can do a lot of damage when nobody has to explain it. And finally, a number flashes across the screen. The woman stands, takes a deep breath, smiles at her daughter, and says, "Maybe this is it." And you can hear how badly she needs that to be true. Maybe today someone finally says yes. Maybe today everything changes. She disappears behind a door, and a few minutes later, she walks back out. And you already know before she says anything. Same papers, same bills, same tired smile, nothing changed. Except maybe the part of her that still believed it might. I used to think poverty was expensive because people in poverty needed help. They needed food, rent, doctors, a little breathing room. That was the story that I understood. Then I started following the dollar. And that is when the whole thing stopped looking simple. Because the dollar leaves your pocket. It goes to the government. Some of it gets marked for people who need help. At least, that is what the line item says. But after that, it starts moving through a machine most Americans never see. And the machine has a lot of doors. A tax office, a landlord, a benefits contractor, a dental clinic, a dialysis chair, a foster care file. And at enough stops, someone has a form, a fee, a contract, a billing code. A reason the dollar has to pass through their hands first. That is the part nobody likes to say too loudly. America spends a staggering amount of money fighting poverty, but the person in poverty is not always where the money lands, and that difference really matters. Sometimes they are not even treated like the customer. They are treated like the reason the customer exists. They become paperwork or a case file, maybe an appointment, a patient in the chair, a child in the system, a reason for someone else to open a file and send an invoice. And once you see it that way, poverty stops feeling like a problem America simply failed to solve. It starts looking like a problem too many people learned how to build. And to be clear, every contractor is not evil. Every landlord is not some cartoon villain hiding in the back office. That version is too easy and too comfortable. The real thing is worse. A system does not need evil people to do ugly things. It only needs the right incentives, or the wrong ones. And in this system, the incentive is painfully simple. The longer poverty lasts, the more people can get paid to manage it. That is the ugly math. So tonight, we are going to follow one poverty dollar, not the speech about it, the dollar itself. We are going through the places where the money actually moves, through the offices, the waiting rooms, the clinics, the call centers, corporate contracts, and the deeper this dollar goes, the harder the pattern is to ignore. Nobody had to steal the money. They just kept billing it and billing it and billing it. To follow this dollar, we have to go back to where it first got its mission, before the contracts, before the billing codes, before the machine got crowded. It's 1964. President Lyndon Johnson stood before the country and declared an unconditional war on poverty. That phrase mattered. It sounded like a promise. The idea was simple. America was wealthy enough that fewer people should have been slipping through the cracks. Programs came online, money moved out, help reached people. Not perfectly, but it reached them. And for a while, the dollar did what it was supposed to do. It moved toward the problem. Poverty rates fell. Millions of older Americans gained health care through Medicare. Millions of low-income families gained access to Medicaid. Food assistance expanded. Housing programs grew. Nobody was trying to build an industry, at least not at the beginning. They were trying to solve a problem. But over the next few decades, the work started moving away from the place people thought it lived. The government kept writing the checks. It just stopped doing as much of the work itself. That is a quiet sentence, but it changes everything. Because beginning in the 1980s, more services were handed to private companies. Helping people still mattered, but more people started believing the private sector could do it faster, cheaper, and better. And those three words did a lot of work. That idea kept going under presidents from both parties, Republican or Democrat. The label changed, the direction mostly did not. By the 1990s, welfare reform and government contracting accelerated the shift. States increasingly hired outside companies to process benefits. They manage healthcare, collect debts, oversee housing, administer programs that had once been handled closer to the public. On paper, well, it made sense. A lot of bad roads start that way. Specialists would do the job more efficiently. Taxpayers would save money. People would get help faster. Everyone wins. That was the pitch. At least that was the theory. Because once private companies entered the picture, something else entered with them. Profit. And profit changes the rule. Profit has one rule. It does not ask what is needed. It asks what gets rewarded. And that single change, more than anything else, redirected where our dollar was about to go. The mission stayed the same. The route did not. Because the government did not stop helping people in poverty. It hired someone else to do it. And that is when our dollar started meeting a lot more hands. So let's follow the dollar. No theory yet, just the path. Forget the budget fight. Forget the speeches and forget the press conference language. $1. Let's pretend this dollar just left your paycheck. It goes to Washington. Congress approves the spending. An agency receives it. Then the money heads to your state. So far, nothing surprising. That is the version most of us understand. But then the trail changes. Quietly, that is the part to watch. The family that needs it waits while the dollar takes a detour. It gets handed to a private company. That company hires another company. Another contract gets signed. Paperwork gets processed. Phones get answered. Eligibility gets reviewed. A database gets managed. Then the machine adds yet another layer. Someone audits the contract that is already auditing the first contractor. By the time our dollar finally reaches the person it was meant to help, it has already paid a whole line of people just for the privilege of moving forward. Now, before we go any further, private companies helping the government is not automatically the problem. Sometimes they really are faster. Sometimes they are better or cheaper. That is not where the story turns. The problem starts when the money keeps flowing best, when the problem never goes away. If you are paid to build a bridge, the job has an ending. At some point, there is a bridge. But what happens when you are paid to manage poverty? What does finished even look like? Every contract has a renewal date, and every renewal depends on need still being there. More processing, more managing, more billing, and suddenly, our dollar is not just moving toward a solution. It is supporting an economy that exists around the problem. That is the moment I realized we had been asking the wrong question all along. For years, we have asked how much money gets spent helping poor people. Fine, but follow the dollar long enough and a nastier question shows up. The one people do not want framed that way. How many people get paid because poor people still need help? Because somewhere along the way, the people in poverty stopped being treated like the customer. Instead, they became the product. The next stop on our dollar journey is a tax office. And I'm not talking about the marble building kind. I'm talking about the strip mall kind. You've probably seen one. Bright signs, red, white, and blue decorations, big windows covered with promises big enough to read from the parking lot. It says maximum refund, money today, walk in, walk out with cash. But inside, people are not celebrating tax season. They are surviving it. That difference matters. A single mom, a retired veteran, a guy who worked two jobs all year and still cannot get ahead. Most of them are not trying to get rich. They are waiting for a refund they already earned. Money that left their paycheck months ago. For a lot of families, that refund is not a bonus. It is how they catch up on rent, fix the car, keep the lights on. I used to think these places were just helping people get their money faster. And sometimes they are. That part is true. But then I started reading the fine print. And the fine print is where the dollar starts losing weight. Refund anticipation loans, processing fees, preparation fees, convenience fees, bank fees, fees, all the little slices nobody talks about until the money is already moving. That is usually when the math gets quiet. Products built around one simple fact, desperation changes math. It changes what feels reasonable. Money today gets loud. Tomorrow's cost gets quiet. Now, let's be fair. Plenty of preparers do honest work. The products vary, the fees vary. But the business exists because the tax code has become so complicated that millions of Americans feel they need someone else just to claim money that is already theirs. That should bother us more than it does. Our dollar has not reached the struggling family yet. It is still paying people to help that family receive their own money. And every fee is small enough to sound reasonable. 30 bucks here, 50 bucks there, a percentage over there. Small enough to explain, big enough to matter. One family may barely notice. Multiply that by millions of tax returns. And now you're not looking at a fee anymore. You're looking at an entire industry. No hacked bank, no stolen wallet, no laws were broken. That is the part that makes it colder. The first cut was perfectly legal. Now, our next stop is an apartment. The kids are riding bikes. Somebody's grilling dinner on a tiny patio. A dog starts barking as we walk past. It is just another place people call home. And that is exactly the point. Inside, a family is finally getting help they desperately needed. Not extra help, just the basic stuff. Part of their rent is covered through a housing voucher. For them, it can be the difference between having a roof or sleeping in a car. That part is very real. Programs like this have helped millions of families stay housed, and that should not get lost in what comes next. But remember, we are following the dollar, and our dollar does not stop with the tenant. It passes through them and goes to the property owner. Every month, like clockwork, guaranteed, and that word matters. Now, put yourself in the landlord's shoes for 1 second. If part of the rent reliably arrives every month, how would that change the way you ran your business? Well, for many landlords, it simply provides stable income. And stable income is not automatically a dirty thing. But economists have also found cases where guaranteed subsidies can influence asking prices, especially in tight housing markets, where voucher limits can start looking less like a ceiling and more like a target. This does not happen everywhere. Plenty of landlords are just renting homes, that is true. But the pattern is still worth looking at. The incentive quietly changes. The apartment becomes more than a home. It becomes a revenue stream. It's reliable, monthly, backed by taxpayers. Again, you do not need fraud for this. You do not need a villain in the back office. Economics can do plenty of damage on its own. People respond to incentives, and when enough people respond the same way, the market starts moving with them. Our dollar helped keep a family housed. Of course that matters. Hold on to that. But it also became part of a business calculation. And that is the part nobody wants to say out loud. Because the apartment did not get better. The roof did not change. The walls did not move. It just got more expensive. The next stop is not a building most people recognize. It's just a phone call, a line you wait on, a system you cannot see, a hold message, maybe a password reset, a form you already filled out twice, or maybe a website that times out right before you hit submit. And somehow, you are the one who has to start over. You know the place. Hell, maybe you have lived there. You call because your kid needs care. Your mom's Medicaid application is stuck. Your food assistance renewal disappeared into whatever digital swamp these things go to die in. There's no person, no answer, just the swamp. And the whole time, you think you are dealing with the government. That is what I thought too. Then I started looking closer. Turns out, in many states, the person on the other end of that process may not be a government worker at all. That detail changes the entire room. It may be a private contractor. One of the biggest is a company called Maximus. You probably have not heard of them, and that is kind of the point. Their product is government services. It's quiet work, hidden work, powerful work. It does eligibility reviews. It has call centers, Medicaid processing, benefit systems. All the boring stuff nobody wants to think about until their life depends on it. And that is where this gets ugly. Because the person applying for help is not really the customer, not in the business sense. The customer is the government, the contract, the renewal, the next state deal. So when people wait on hold, miss deadlines, get buried in paperwork, or lose coverage because one document did not land right, it may look like government failure, and sometimes it is. But not always. Sometimes it is private business wearing a government mask. Now, to be fair, these companies can do useful work. Some programs are massive, complicated, messy as hell. States need help running them. Fine, I get that. That can all be true. But a company paid to manage the process can start depending on that process. And once that happens, the process itself becomes valuable. The forms, the calls, the reviews, the delays, the whole miserable maze. Not because anyone has to say, make it worse. Just because the maze itself is now part of the business. And suddenly, our dollar is doing more than helping someone get benefits. It is paying a company to stand between that person and the help. So that is where the dollar changes character. Because the longer the process, the more valuable the process becomes. Now, the next stop looks harmless. That is what makes it worse. Because nothing about it looks like a machine. It's a children's dental office with bright walls, cartoon fish, tiny chairs, everything designed to tell a parent you can breathe. A TV playing something loud enough to wear down every parent in the room. Kids wait with Medicaid cards tucked in their mom's purse. A little plastic card that can decide whether pain gets treated. No family walked in looking for a scam. They walked in because a child had a toothache. That is the part to remember. And dentists who take Medicaid matter. A lot of families would have no dental care without them. So this is not about pretending the help is fake. The help is very real. But then you start reading the lawsuits, and the waiting room starts feeling different. There are unnecessary procedures. Crowns kids did not need. There are extractions, root canals. Bills sent to Medicaid for work that should never have happened. Not mistakes around the edges. Work on children. And once again, the incentive is sitting right there in the open. Medicaid pays per procedure. More procedures mean more billing. That is just the cold truth. And suddenly, the incentive is not abstract anymore. It is sitting in the chair. Most dentists are not doing this. That needs to be said out loud. Don't lose that. But when a clinic builds its business around volume, and the patients are poor, young, disabled, or less likely to fight back, that is when the room gets colder. Because now the patient is vulnerable, and the billing opportunity is sitting right there. Our dollar was supposed to help a child get care. In some cases, it became a reason to do more work than the child needed. That is the line this whole stop turns on. That is not healthcare. That is a billing strategy with a cartoon mural on the wall. And the smile painted on the wall was not the scary part. The scary part was the math behind it. The next stop is quiet, and it's too quiet. It's the kind of quiet that makes you lower your voice without even thinking. A dialysis clinic does not feel like a place where money moves fast. It feels slow, measured, routine, heavy with a row of chairs, blankets pulled up to people's chests, machines humming beside them, doing the work their kidneys no longer can. For a lot of patients, those machines are the reason they are still here alive. I have been in rooms like this before. My father spent years in one of those chairs. So this one is not abstract for me. The waiting, hoping a kidney would come before time ran out. And if you ever loved someone in that chair, you know what that waiting does to a family. When your kidneys fail, your blood still has to be cleaned. If your body cannot do it, the machine has to. The machine itself is not the ugly part, of course. The ugly part starts when survival becomes a business model. And that sentence should feel very wrong. Because dialysis is not usually one visit. It is three times a week, week after week, month after month. A life organized around a chair. Every treatment creates another bill, another reimbursement, another quiet movement of money through the system. Again, most of the people working here are not villains. They are nurses, techs, doctors, people who choose one of the hardest jobs imaginable, people trying to keep someone else alive, and that matters intensely. Don't lose that. But the business sitting above that room plays by different rules. A full chair regenerates revenue. An empty chair does not. That is the sentence that changes the temperature in the room. And the one thing that can permanently empty that chair, the thing everyone should be hoping for, is a successful kidney transplant. That is where this story gets harder to look at. Dialysis is supposed to keep patients alive while they wait for a new kidney. Over the years, some for-profit dialysis companies have faced allegations and lawsuits claiming the incentives did not always point toward transplant. In some claims, the concern was simple. Keeping patients on dialysis could be more profitable than moving them aggressively toward transplant evaluation or referral. Those claims remain debated. The companies deny wrongdoing. Many physicians fight every day to get their patients transplanted as quickly as possible. But the fact that this debate exists at all should make us sit still for just a second, because it exposes something bigger than dialysis. Our dollar entered the room to help someone get better. But in a system like this, treatment can be rewarded more than recovery. And that is the part I could not shake. Because when my father was in that chair, I never looked around the room and saw villains. No, instead, I saw people trying to get through another day. I saw nurses who legitimately cared, doctors who were exhausted, families holding on to hope. So the deeper I looked, bad people became harder to find. The system became harder to ignore. A system rewarding an outcome nobody in that room wanted. I was not ready to admit it yet, at least not completely. But for the first time, I started wondering if I had been looking for the wrong villain, not a person or a design, because that is not a conspiracy. That is just math with a pulse. And a patient who no longer needs that chair does not generate another invoice. That is the part that sits there after the machines stop humming. Okay, so now we move on to the next stop, and the next stop does not look like a business. It looks like a file cabinet, a quiet one, the kind nobody thinks about until a child's life is incited, a case number, a child. And somewhere between those two things, the system starts speaking its own language. Maybe their parents are gone. Maybe they are disabled. Maybe there is nobody left to fight for these kids. Nobody with time, nobody with power. Or nobody who knows which office to call. Somewhere in that file, there is money. Not extra money or bonus. It's a child's money. This is money that belongs to the child, a benefit tied to their loss, or their disability, for their future, which means the money is already carrying grief before anyone touches it. Sometimes it is a Social Security survivor benefit because a parent died. Other times it is a disability benefit meant to help support them. The purpose is simple. Give that child a better chance after life has already taken so much. But then the trail turned again, and this one is very hard to sit with. In many states, child welfare agencies have legally used those benefits to help reimburse the cost of the child's own foster care. So, listen to that slowly again. Rewind it and listen to that again. The child's own money used to help pay for the system holding the child. The practice has existed for years. Some states have begun changing it after lawsuits and public pressure and new policies. Others are still wrestling with it. A child loses a parent. Money is set aside to help that child. Then the system responsible for protecting the child uses that same money to help pay itself. And it's legal. Now, that does not automatically make it right. We know that. And this is exactly where legality starts sounding too small for the damage. Just like every stop before this, the social worker is usually not the villain here. The foster parent usually is not either. Of course, this matters. Most of them are trying to help children through unimaginable circumstances. But the system quietly found another revenue stream, and this time, the revenue stream had a child's name on it. A place where our dollar, or in this case, their dollar, could keep moving. The hardest part is not a broken law. It is a system designed to protect children, slowly learning how to bill them. Somewhere, a child became the funding source. And somewhere, a child became the line item. By now, that dollar that we've been following has been almost everywhere. Or at least everywhere most people never think to look. A tax office, an apartment, a call center, a children's dentist, a dialysis clinic, a foster care file. Different doors, same dollar, all these different rooms. Different names on the paperwork, different people trying to get through the day. And still, the same shape kept appearing. The same outcome kept showing up. And that is when poverty started looking like the surface of the story. The engine underneath was incentives. Somewhere along the way, I realized I had been asking the wrong question. I started this investigation looking for bad people. People cheating the system, getting rich while everyone else suffered. And sure, those people exist, of course. They always will. But they were not the driving force behind this story. The deeper I looked, the more good people kept showing up. People trying to do good work, like nurses, social workers, case managers, landlords trying to keep buildings running, doctors trying to save lives. People inside the machine not standing above it. Nobody woke up that morning thinking, how can I keep someone poor today? They woke up, went to work, and responded to the incentives sitting in front of them. That is what incentives do. They do not need to change who people are. They only have to change what gets rewarded. And after enough years, the system starts producing exactly what it was designed to reward. Back in that government waiting room, that little girl with the crayons is probably asking her mom if they can go home now. She's tired. She has no more patience. That is where this story started. And it is still where the story hurts. She has no idea we have just followed her dollar through all those rooms. She does not know about the contracts or the renewals, the billing codes. She only knows she is still waiting. That is what finally hit me like a pound of bricks. The real threat was bigger than corruption, bigger than greed. It was bigger than one bad company. It was a system where solving the problem too quickly could mean somebody somewhere stopped getting paid. And once that becomes normal, the system does not have to be broken. It simply keeps doing exactly what it was built to do. The people making money were not always breaking the system. Sometimes they're just following it. After following that dollar through all those rooms, I could not stop thinking about one question. The usual question is, why is there poverty? That is the question we are used to asking. But another question kept bothering me. It's a much quieter one. And it's, who gets smaller if poverty gets smaller? It is an uncomfortable thing to ask, because when people hear it, they assume you are accusing someone. But I am not. I am asking how systems behave when survival depends on the problem staying large enough to manage. Think about everything we've seen. Different industries, different rooms, different people doing different jobs. But they all had one thing in common. Someone got paid because the problem still existed. That does not mean they want the problem to continue. Most of them don't because they're good people. And that distinction matters. But the money keeps flowing only as long as there is something left to manage. And that is a very different kind of incentive. I kept wanting this investigation to end with one bad guy, or one corporation, a crooked politician, a smoking gun. That would have been easier. But instead, I found something harder to argue with and harder to point at. I found budgets, contracts, renewals, performance targets, quarterly earnings, annual appropriations. None of those things by themselves are evil. They are just numbers on a paper, until people start organizing their decisions around them. However, together, they quietly shape human behavior. When enough people respond to those incentives year after year, the system begins protecting itself. Which leaves us with a question almost nobody asks. If poverty became dramatically smaller over the next 10 years, how many contracts would disappear? How many departments would shrink? How many companies would lose customers, go out of business? How many business models would have to reinvent themselves? I don't know the answer to that, but after following the dollar, I do not think we get to avoid that question, because some problems are hard to solve, and some problems make too much damn money for too many people to solve quickly. For just a moment, let's go back to where we started. Forget the numbers, to the room, the waiting room, the little girl with the broken crayons. Her mother is still holding the same folder, still hoping someone calls her name, still trying not to let her daughter see how tired she is. She has no idea where we've been, no idea we followed her daughter across America. She only knows she is still waiting. And maybe that is the real lesson underneath all this. Healthcare, education, housing, poverty. They're different systems, but the same warning. Over time, every system becomes perfectly designed for the results it keeps creating, even when nobody wants to admit those are the results. So maybe poverty survives because solving it fast enough does not reward enough people. Maybe too many people learned how to make a living managing it. And maybe that is why the problem keeps outliving the promises. So the real question is, are these the results we actually want, or just the results we have learned to accept? Because somewhere, a little girl is still sitting in that waiting room, still holding a broken crayon, still waiting for her name to be called. I'm Ralph, and this is Divergent Files. Until next time, stay curious, stay sharp, and remember, no matter what they say, the truth is still out there.